Welcome to EFX Unfiltered. This is where we deconstruct the changes that are happening in the EFX industry right now. I'll be talking to David Cooney, an industry veteran of 27 years, to tease out the essential life lessons for anyone in EFX. Each podcast will open up your mind and give you an idea of how to keep up with the rapid evolution of EFX. EFX Unfiltered. Hello everyone, welcome to the first episode and thanks for tuning in. I'm going to chat to co-founder of MahiFX about how the FX industry has transformed over the last 30 years. So David, you began your career in FX in 1987. Tell me a little bit about your experience.
Look, we were a group of currency options traders and it was at Dresdner that we really started, we had anything to do with EFX, and it was very late in our time at Dresdner. They'd built a thing called Piranha, which was a pretty slick looking front end. Very little sitting behind it in terms of the rate formation or risk management or whatever, you know, real shop window kind of stuff. And the limitations of that, of the lack of pricing sophistication or any risk management and stuff, were starting to become evident. And my business partner and I, and we sort of had started that process when Barclays came calling and wanted us to go down there and run their options business. Our boss, Ivan Ratosa, you know, mentioned it might be good if we were have a wee look at the FX pricing risk management they had going on with Barclays. It was kind of a similar story, to be fair. They had a great looking shop window. They had a, you know, reasonable, looking back at it, wasn't that big a deal, but they had a few customers on it and a bit of flow going through enough to gather some data and so on. And we started having a wee look at it. You know, predictably enough, we took the same sort of approach to the rate formation risk running as we did with the currency options business, which was, you know, very much that of market making and efficient market theory, portfolio of risk and skew and all that kind of stuff. And we progressively just built out some simple pricing risk management stuff at the same time as we had some smart friends of ours who we'd hired. They were building what we thought was going to be like an analytics system, but because they were bloody clever, they built it around a complex event processing engine that became the foundation of everything we sort of did going forward. Now, the CEP was awesome because you could just, like, try stuff out, instrument, you know, a particular node, it would give you output on how it was doing and stuff, and we could isolate what was happening, and, you know, if it wasn't going so good, we'd rip it out and try something different. And it was a real process, I suppose, of Darwinism, to try stuff out and just adapt. So that was how we did it, and then it was just a process from there on in, really, of improving the thing and running it super data-driven and being really diligent about instrumentation and all that kind of stuff. And as much as anything, it was really about just trying things out and isolating what didn't work, and if you do that for long enough, you end up with what's left being stuff that does, and that's really what Barclays was about.
So you were right at the centre of the digital transformation for FX and banking. At a time when no one believed that computers would replace voice traders. What were the biggest changes you experienced back then?
I suppose the big thing was when we got started down at Barclays, you know, there were really very limited number of consistent sources of price discovery and electronic price discovery. You know, the dominant environments were EBS and Reuters. You know, there were the sort of like Challenger ECNs, the hotspots and Currenexes and whatnot, and obviously those things have taken off, and so now you've got a lot of admittedly fragmented price discovery. There are clearly things you can do to try and get an edge. We always thought about was sort of like, you know, rate source manipulation, so where we would be at Barclays streaming to market user banks who would themselves have access to Reuters or EBS, it was possible, and some did, that they would manipulate the rate, you know, bid it up in order to sell it and stuff. Yeah, they could do that. Latency arbitrage was just a fact of life. And one of the things that we were terrible at dealing with initially, but, you know, you quickly learn by being kicked in the head often enough. And then there is dealing not full. I'm not 100% that, you know, those things were not exploited by voice traders back in the day. I mean, spoofing was pretty endemic. Dealing not full, sweeping, I mean, that was a fact of life. You know, going out on calls, that was exactly what you did, make me a market in 10 at the same time as you were selling 10 other guys in 10. And then that got translated to, or transferred, I suppose, to the electronic space, where it was a little bit like, okay, well, these things are a bit bad, they present challenges to electronic market makers, but because it's just, we've got so much more data to deal with, you hope, you acknowledge that it's a vulnerability in the in the system. You've calibrated to work in one, and somebody is selling across the market something in 10, that's probably not, you know, going to work out that well. But you can use data to isolate when the stuff is going on. You know, you get a number of samples and the picture becomes pretty clear, and you modify the quality of service that that particular consumer receives. So I guess the biggest change is everything just becoming data driven, right? Rather than being driven by anecdote, it became driven by data. Because the machine was producing the rate and you could customize that rate, you know, you were able to tune prices so that you delivered the price that a particular customer deserved. What's relevant here is, you know, the whole debate about last look, right? Last look really exists as protection against people who are systematically taking advantage of the turn of the rate. If you've got clients who don't do that, then the likelihood is competitive pressure means that no one will last look their business. If, on the other hand, you've got somebody, the only time they trade is when they're trying to capture the turn of the price, by which I mean, you know, going from 18.2 to 18.6 to, I don't know, whatever, 17.8, 18.2. If that's the only time that they're looking to trade, you're probably going to have either punitive, defensive last look parameters, or you're going to maybe go, well, I don't really want to deal with a client who's only doing that kind of business. So the ability to customize the client experience was kind of key in EFX. You know, it wasn't the kind of thing that you could do as a human. You know, you started dealing in million microseconds and all that kind of stuff. It was never really an issue in the voice space. So you had a real emergence, you know, sort of revenge of the nerds thing going on, where it went from the, you know, the crafty trader veterans to guys who understood, you know, network topology. It's not a static environment, and it's not static now.
Considering your background in banking, what advice would you give to the guys in the retail space?
Oh, the retail market's very much on its way to looking like the institutional space has for a long time, you know, with spread compression. The tighter spreads get, the more predatory customers, people who want to take advantage of latency arbitrage or, you know, the ability to deal not fucked, to deal for effect, if you like, the more they can play those kind of games, right? Let's go back to a fantasy land where euro-dollar spreads are 3 pips wide. Yeah, you're going to struggle to capture a turn of a price against that kind of spread. So in other words, the spread covers up a multitude of sins. You start getting spreads down to 0.1, 0.2 and whatnot, and it becomes kind of trivial for people to trump what little spread there is with superior information to what you've got. You know, the classic sort of model really of banging stuff into the B-book, that model starts to get seriously challenged when you get spreads having compressed to the point that they have now. So it's becoming institutional in character, you know, the distinction between retail and institutional. Once you get retail spreads at institutional levels, it really becomes very blurred. And so I guess you've got to start applying the same sort of like institutional techniques and discrimination and judgment about what you want to put in your B book and what you don't.
So how can retail brokers improve the way they run their business?
You know, they're effectively institutional market makers, right? In a lot of cases, they've outsourced their rate formation to primer primes or heavily aggregated price streams, which pretty much guarantees that their rate evolution is going to be slow. If you get a move, let's say, down in a price, and you have, I don't know, 15 or 20 LPs in your pool, you know, one guy's going to move fast, dest, and then there'll be other guys who, you know, move in succession, you know, kind of like cars pulling away from traffic lights or something. You know, and we all know, right, that sort of like accordion means that the last guy to move away from the lights does it quite a long time after the lights have changed. That's what happens with prices on the turn in a heavily aggregated environment. Because of phase differences with which the LPs receive the information, differences in the speed with which they process it, throttles by which they can publish it, you guarantee by putting more liquidity providers into the mix that you're predicating your best bidder offer, which is generally what people use to determine the B-book decision, not on the first car to get away from the lights, but that guy who's very, very, you know, the last in his crappy old Skoda. So instead, you need to listen to the information earlier in the piece, you know, as soon as you practically can, and you need to be able to display a rate, I think, that represents your business, you know, that is crafted to match the different client sets that a B-book broker or that a broker faces, and that perhaps incorporates some skew to encourage the portfolio to clear itself. And if you're using other people's rates, obviously it's got whatever skew, positional skew information it's got in it is appropriate to their position, not yours. If you're running risk, seems to me you have a preference for one side of the rate or the other, so that you can, you know, achieve greater internalizations, lower ambient amounts of risk, you know, less VAR utilization, you know, less volatile P&L as a result, all that kind of stuff. So a little bit of skew is kind of good. Now, the only way you can incorporate that is to have the pricing being aware of what your position is. If you're taking responsibility for, you know, being able to put up different client types, you need to have different models, different behaviours to map to the different class of client that you see. You know, obviously, you'd probably want a different model, different characteristics in that model to face off against pure, very pure retail versus, say, B2B business. You end up needing technology to allow you to create, to listen to the source information as quickly as possible, to create bespoke models appropriate to the classes of client you face, and that incorporates skew according to your position. Basically, you need to adopt the same technology as the institutional guys have had for a while, and kind of that's what Mahi's about, is the ability to drop in with Compass, a bank-grade, institutional-grade pricing and risk management technology, into the business which is originating the business. Instances separate and distinct to each client is so that it can become something which reflects their business. It isn't a one-size-fits-all proposition.
And what do you think will be the outcome for brokers that choose not to operate on a more institutional level?
Let's take the B-book broker first, right? If they're predicating what goes into their B-book on a heavily aggregated stack, you do see, I mean, we see it in analyses we run, that there is a decent proportion of the flow going into the B-book, which is going in on the wrong side of mid at inception. Now, that's going to destroy value. Back in the day, you would take the view, well, you know, all retail traders lose. You know, the fact that it was offside at inception, that's not going to be too big a deal because there's a behavioural overlay where they will stop themselves out. That's not true when you get into the institutional space. When the spreads are so tight, people can be in and out of their positions, which basically locks the loss inside of the B-book. The profitability of the B-book will diminish if, you know, spreads compress, if you're not filtering out the stuff which is at the wrong price, right? So that's the first thing, kind of got to do that. Second thing is, it doesn't make sense to me, never has, to run, you know, gargantuan amounts of risk. At the point of inception, you've got the best proportion of spread to mid versus the risk that you're ever going to have. So the ratio, if you like, of signal to noise at the birth of the trade is at its absolute best. And then very quickly, your edge, you know, as time goes by and you hold that position, your edge is gone and all you're left with is noise. So the ratio of signal to noise just gets worse and worse and worse. So in other words, the sharp ratio, if you want, you know, the volatility of the P&L just gets worse by virtue of holding the risk. So what you actually do want to be doing is encouraging the portfolio to clear, to self-clear, judiciously hedging, you know, the fringes of your risk. And that ends up with just greater predictability of returns, higher quality of returns. And if you're doing it well, there's no diminution in return. In fact, it becomes greater generally because most of the yield profiles that we ever see, there's more yield early in the piece than there is later in the piece. So in other words, if you can take your holding periods to the left, shorten them, not only do you improve sharp ratios and whatnot, but you actually end up making more cash. Really the only way in which, you know, obviously in the limit, you can take your holding period to zero, and then you're an A-book broker. But at that point, you're paying somebody else's spread. So that's probably not the optimal model either. So what it ends up being, I suppose, and it's kind of what we believe, is intelligent market making, where you're looking to keep holding periods as short as possible and have the highest yield for the least amount of risk, highest quality of returns. You know, the guys who do this most successfully end up with some degree of network effect, because their holding periods become shorter and shorter, the quality of their returns get higher and higher, and they can therefore, they either enjoy, you know, better profits, or if they wish, if the elasticity of all of this makes sense, they can actually reduce costs for their customers and acquire more business. So I think in the end, the people who are gonna grow their business are gonna end up looking a lot like institutional market makers, and they're gonna achieve a network effect. Ends up with, you know, a greater amount of consolidation.
Thanks for sharing your experiences, David. It sounds like you played a pretty central role in the digital transformation of FX. And a lot of the issues you were dealing with 15 years ago are the same sort of problems that the retail market is starting to become exposed to. So making money just isn't as easy as it used to be. To stay ahead of the game, you need to have the right technology in place. You need to be able to anticipate client behavior, and you need to be able to make decisions based on the information you have. We're talking sub-millisecond. and you need to be able to make sure that your pricing is on point. In the following podcasts, we'll take a closer look at how to combat latency arbitrage, why price formation is fundamental to profitability, and why the traditional A-book, B-book model is out of date in today's environment.